Happy Independence Day. But what really happened 250 years ago? And what was it with those founding fathers? A closer look at our history on The Cities. There are bits and pieces we all know about the founding of our nation. Patriots, Loyalists, George Washington, Ben Franklin, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson. But what was it really like 250 years ago when the colonies were just colonies? Augustana College history professor Lendell Calder joined me for another look at the founding of our nation and the people behind it. Tell me about the Declaration of Independence. I mean, everyone thinks that it burst out of the minds of Thomas Jefferson, and it's far more than that.
Well, in some ways it did burst out of his mind, and that who saw that coming when he and four others sat down to explain the mind of Americans to the rest of the world. Well, this is one of our two great documents that sets up the foundation of the country, the Constitution being the other one. Lincoln famously called the Declaration our golden apple, an inheritance that belongs to every American. And It's a declaration that doesn't get read much anymore in schools. Students come to college. I find that sometimes they've never read it. So it's a great pleasure to fix that in a college-level course, because this is a document that had profound implications for world history.
Because it's more than just a list of grievances.
Yeah, this document's important for three reasons. First of all, it set out the reasons for why people might revolt. And it inaugurated then an age of revolutions, starting here, but next in France, then across Latin American countries. This notion that the sovereignty lies with the people and they have a right to revolt when the system of government is not responsive to their needs, it was revolutionary.
Unprecedented. I mean, because you think of it, it was a period of time when monarchies ruled.
That's right. That's right. And these ideas aren't brand new out of Jefferson's mind. They had existed for centuries in some cases in dusty paper documents and books. But people had been talking about them for years in the lead up to the revolution. Some of these ideas had been put together in a document 1 month before Jefferson wrote the Declaration, a document where Virginia explained why they were joining the revolutionary cause. And he cribbed quite a bit from that, those Virginia resolutions. But it's a work of real rhetorical genius and a great courage, Jim, and it's also a great collective failure of will to actually follow through on the implications of these ringing phrases, especially those in the second sentence, that we hold these truths to be self-evident. Now, one out of four people in the colonies was an enslaved person when Jefferson wrote those words. And the debate over slavery was already in full tilt. So we're not importing this back into time and finding reasons to be against slavery in the Declaration. No, I mean, three of the five people who wrote the Declaration were abolitionists. And when they changed the wording of John Locke, life, liberty, and property, that's the original wording. Mm-hmm. That's what Jefferson wrote in the original draft to the Declaration. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. We have rights to that. The abolitionists changed it to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, because property was being used to enslave people at the time, and they didn't want that to be in this Declaration. So there's a debate, an internal debate, right there in the Declaration as this new idea of popular sovereignty and of equality, as these ideas are kind of loosed on the world, and they're unruly ideas. None of these five guys who wrote it, none of the people who voted for it on July the 2nd, none of them knew where the ideas were going to take them and take this country. But the ideas matured very quickly, and there were people who signed up for this revolution who believed that these ideas of equality and popular sovereignty meant that the United States was committed to the project of being a multi-ethnic, multi-religious, and multi-racial democracy. That was the experiment that the revolutionaries were embarked on.
It was also in a period of time, as you alluded to, a period of great compromise in order to get the Declaration
Constitution. Because they didn't agree on these things.
Because you had 13 very independent separate colonies.
That's right. Remember, there were 26 colonies
I didn't know
that England had over here in the Americas. And only 13 came together for this revolution. The 13 in the Caribbean said, count us out. Because their enslaved people from Africa far outnumbered the whites, and they needed the power of the imperial state to maintain that system. So they couldn't join the American Revolution.
It seems inconceivable that a backwards frontier would have, at one moment in time, amazing intellects with a number of founding fathers, not just one. I mean, everyone talks about George Washington, but there's names that people don't even remember that were so instrumental in the development of this country.
It's a remarkable moment, and we can celebrate it for that. You know, as a historian, I can lead people through a consideration of why these men and a few women came together at this time, what prepared them. But, you know, Jim, at the end of the day, there's something almost a little bit weird about it, miraculous maybe.
Very much so.
And that's one of my rules about history. You are not telling a true history till you found the weirdness in the story. Because history's always a little bit weird, or weirder than you think it ought to be.
A couple of the great things that you pointed out, one was that there were a number of drafts to the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. And one of the great things is that you see the original that Thomas Jefferson had presented. And you see the lines being drawn through it. That alone is a jewel in itself, because you could see the thinking that was going on.
And this was new. We have empires in the world and the First Nation states, but they'd all existed for a long time. Their existences and their origin stories predated written history. When James Madison shows up at the Constitutional Convention, he comes with a pen and a notebook. He makes it his ambition to record every word said at the convention. He said it felt like he had gone back to the beginning of time. Because they had, as theorists, debated how do human beings come together in political societies, but nobody knew. It had never been observed before. And here they were doing it, observing it in real time. And so he wrote it down. And we have preserved these drafts of the Declaration. These were religious texts.
The other document that I enjoy is John Adams' letter to Abigail Adams on July 3rd. That was written, if I may quote for just a moment here. He wrote that he was disappointed the Declaration was delayed 7 months at that point, saying an earlier Declaration could have assured alliances, conquered Quebec, and taken Canada. But the delay also extinguished hopes of reconciliation, gave people time to mature their views, and better cemented the Union.
Not everybody wanted this revolution. Even George Washington, at the First Continental Congress, just the summer before, had said, nobody here wants to be independent, and they called it independency. But things change, and then all of a sudden change in a big way, and people sign up for this daring and dangerous adventure. It was John Randolph who answered one of the delegates. One of the delegates said, we're not ripe for a revolution yet, so let's not published this declaration. And Randolph said, we are ripe to rotting, sir. Let's get it. Let's do it.
And in some ways, in that very hot Pennsylvania room, they were pretty ripe at that point.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about what happened later, because at that point, the Declaration of Independence, 250 years ago, there was an estimate that about 20% of the Americans, as I'm calling them now, were loyalists. Fewer patriots, perhaps 12% they even thought, and most were what was called fence sitters. So the country hadn't really coalesced yet either.
That's right. John Adams famously said, one-third were revolutionary, one-third were loyal to the king, and one-third went back and forth, depending on who held the upper hand in their locality. So this was a civil war, not just a decolonial war or a revolutionary war. And it was a horrible civil war. The atrocities committed on both sides make you want to weep.
But it was also a war in some ways of propaganda for the Patriots to actually win over the country. The British didn't help their cause in any way, but the Declaration of Independence really was in some ways a further step of creating a more perfect union.
That's right, and it was one of many things that were published to promote the cause, or published to attack the cause of revolution. That's one of the remarkable things about this moment. The American colonists were a reading public, and pamphlets poured out the printing press by the thousands, and people read them, and they debated them in taverns and on street corners and in living rooms. In churches, yeah.
Anybody lucky enough to be able to pay for a newspaper would read it in a, as you said, in a pub, in a tavern, which was a meeting place for Americans at that point. The way the information was disseminated may have been slower, but not any less effective.
And these ideas had a very wide reach. So you see, enslaved people, enslaved black people, taking the ideas of the Declaration and immediately quoting it back to their white enslavers and saying, well, if we hold these truths to be self-evident, what are you doing enslaving me? And so the abolitionist movement in Massachusetts is kicked off in a big way by the publication of the Declaration of Independence. And then the course of the war with the British offering amnesty to slaves who cross over and fight for the British. Yeah, it's a major support for the abolitionist cause.
You are not only a historian, but you're also an expert and an educator about history education. And congratulations on the award that you received last year, national recognition for
the work
that you have done.
Thank you.
So tell me, do we whitewash this period of history too much? Do we, as you said, you want to find those little nuggets that tell the story in even greater detail. Do we not find enough of those?
Well, it depends on who we is in that sentence. Do we whitewash? The days are long gone that official school texts whitewash the past, with some exceptions. Every once in a while you hear a horror story about enslaved people being described in a seventh grade textbook as laborers or something ridiculous like that. But those are the exceptions that kind of prove the rule I'm talking about. School history across the 50 states today is mostly a balanced history, with the exception of states who have recently set up new regulations for the teaching of a more patriotic, heritage-based approach to history. And by heritage here, we mean history as a monument for praise and celebration. I don't, as a historian, have any problem with history memorializing moments in our past, because there's so much beauty, so much courage, so much adventure in the American story. We should be celebrating those things. But certain states here in the past 10 years want to institute a state-sponsored approach to history that defines what happened and what can be taught to students and what can't be taught. And that compromises the very nature of history instruction. I mean, history comes from a Greek word that means inquiry, historia. And so when I'm teaching history, I want to teach students to work their way towards beliefs, to stories, to interpretations that end in question marks, as they discipline themselves to be humble about what they know. Heritage history, the kind that some states now are experimenting with, wants to end all statements about the past with an exclamation point. America's great because America is good! Exclamation point. That's not history anymore. That's heritage, where you tell a positive story that makes people feel good about themselves. The problem with it is almost all heritage stories make some people feel good about themselves by making other people feel bad. And the story becomes an us versus them story. We're the good people. They, the wicked they, are out to get us. That kind of story has students need to be taught that's one approach to history and made aware of why that just doesn't work. Americans have been arguing over what our story is for 275 years. I mean, even before the Revolution. Sure. That's the history we should be learning, the history of that argument over what our story is and who we are as a people. And the Declaration of Independence will always be the primary text for this because that is what binds us. I mean, we're not bound by our skin color. We're not bound by a common religion. We're not bound by a basketball team that we all root for. Go Spurs, by the way.
We're not bound by a king. We're not bound by a monarchy.
None of that traditionally binds a people works for the Americans. What has binded us are these truths that we hold to be self-evident.
We're allowing your Texas background here for just a moment, so we're going to ignore that. But really, when you talk about this nation in 250 years, and you talk about it starting with the Declaration of Independence, as you said, happened before that, of course. But then take a look after that. You have a bloody Revolutionary War that, thank goodness for a few moments in time whether you're talking about Trenton or if you're talking about anything that George Washington did in order to outwit the British. You talk about the Articles of Confederation and the failure of the creation of the United States of America as a government, and then the success of the Constitution. As you said, these are all in the first decades of the creation. This could have been a failed experiment a long time ago.
Well, the very first Federalist paper, and the Federalist papers were about 70 pamphlets published to promote the newly drafted Constitution. Well, the very first Federalist paper used this expression, that we are embarked on a great experiment. They really believed that, and they were worried it wasn't going to work. They were mostly worried that there would be a short shelf life for this Republican experiment in democracy. It had never been done before, never even tried before. And it's the first time a polity have come together around the basis of a set of ideas instead of a set of time-honored inherited practices that had come down from God. It had not been done before. It's really revolutionary in that sense. And it all still remained to be worked out. Who would be part of this polity? Will slaves be part of it? That remains to be worked out. What about women? Will they be part of it? Can they be citizens? Should they be part of the body politic? That remains to be worked out. They were feeling their way forward in a fog, step by step, without knowing where this was going, where these unruly ideas are going to take them. And that's the story of American history. It's the story of people who believed in those ideas and want to expand them, and Americans who are suspicious of the ideas, worry that they're not enough to really make a people, and so resist them.
Is there a strong belief that you have of American exceptionalism when you take a look at how the nation was created?
You know, we fight a lot over that word.
Yes,
historians,
we do.
The general public. I myself believe that America is an exceptional history in the sense that this idea that surfaces in the Declaration of Independence is a truly exceptional idea. Nobody had made that the basis for a government before. That's brand new in human events. It's exceptional.
And 250 years ago?
And the attempt to create a multiracial, multicultural, multiethnic democracy is it's not, we're not the only ones who are trying to do it, but it's darn near exceptional still. And we, I would argue, has succeeded at it better than anyone else who's tried. Of course, we're hypocritical, and of course, the ideas remain to be worked out. Of course. But what's the alternative to hypocrisy? To not have ideals at all? Is that really what we want? I don't think so. So, the wonder, the beauty, the adventure of the American story is that it's a has a chapter for every generation to write. And each generation of Americans steps up to run the experiment, which means it could fail. It, with each generation, that's the terror and the inspiration of the American project.
Our thanks to Augustana College history professor Lendell Calder. Dr. Calder was honored last year with the Eugene Asher Distinguished Teaching Award presented by the American Historical Association for outstanding teaching and advocacy for history education. We are now in the month of July, and it's more than just fireworks and apple pie, though both are pretty nice. Here's some of the events going on in our area, thanks to Visit Quad Cities.
Check out the things to do this week in the Quad Cities. The entire month of July, you can check out the Figge Art Museum for free. Don't miss out on this opportunity. Next, enjoy a classic movie come to life in a musical adventure. The Wizard of Oz is taking the stage at Circa 21 Dinner Playhouse. Then, relax this summer with free yoga in the park. Enjoy fresh air with beautiful views. Then, spend your weekend at the world's largest truck stop for the 48th annual Walcott Truckers Jamboree. Finally, experience live music, pop-up shops, lawn games, and so much more at Second Saturdays in downtown Rock Island. For more events like these, check out our events calendar at visitquadcities.com.
Murray Lee is a singer, songwriter, and acoustic guitarist, and we invited him to take the stage at the Black Box Theater in Moline to perform one of his originals. So here's Murray Lee with Claustrophobic.
Flipping through a news article about our brains, their size and their shape, our genetic. Oh, what an awful trick. I was reading chapters in a people's history of the United States. Oh, what an awful place to be. And I'm too poor to leave. I was reading in a science journal about Mother Earth, her fever's getting worse. Oh, I'm stuck in a hearse. I was trying to understand a Brian Green book about space-time and how our strings are attached to it. Oh, we can't leave this universe. Thank you. while skipping through a news article about our brains.
Murray Lee with Claustrophobic performed at Moline's Black Box Theater. We are continuing to celebrate the 250th birthday of the Declaration of Independence by celebrating the civic spark in many of us. It showcases the reason our work makes a difference in our community. And as long as we're looking back at history, we figured we'd ask a historian about his civic spark. Neil Dahlstrom knows all things John Deere. As Deere's resident historian, we wanted to know what drives him to tell the story of John Deere. What is his civic spark?
I just think people are inspiring. Their thoughts, their creativity, just kind of how they work out problems, how they learn, whether it's John Deere, Charles Deere, William Butterworth, like a company like John Deere that has a rich legacy of people working out ideas. I just find it incredibly inspiring, and it drives me to just learn more, to do more, and to kind of share what I learn with other people.
Our thanks to Deere historian Neil Dahlstrom. And from all of our Civic Spark participants, and from everyone here at WQPT and Western Illinois University, happy 250th Independence Day. On the air, on the radio, on the web, on your mobile device, and streaming on your computer, thanks for taking some time to join us as we talk about the issues on the cities.